carry on. All through the years and centuries, in all realms, men in life's middle time have behaved at the highest, and their triumphs have been the most momentous in life's middle time. One thinks of John Wesley in life's middle time at the very acme of his power, and of John Knox, and of Martin Luther. One thinks of Victor Hugo and Oliver Wendell Holmes in life's middle time, moving the world with their pens. One thinks of Gladstone, beginning in life's middle time, to forecast the marvelous career that was to be his in statecraft. And Michelangelo, in the great realm of art. One thinks of John Milton, writing his Paradise Lost in life's middle time. And of Bunyan, writing the book, next to the Word of God in influence over mankind, Pilgrim's Progress in life's middle time. One thinks of our great statesmen in life's middle time who recorded their great victories. Webster made his immortal reply to Hayne when Webster was in the middle passage of life. Henry Clay made his great utterances on the Missouri Compromise in life's middle time. Patrick Henry gave a speech under a critical hour of our country's life that will echo around the world through all the ages. I know not what course others may take, but as for me, give me liberty or give me death. In life's middle time, that great utterance came. Wellington came to his great victory at Waterloo. In life's middle passage. And Caesar crossed the Rubicon in the middle passage of the great soldier's life. Now, in the realms of business, the fact obtains just the same, that in life's middle time, men reach the acme of their power. A great Hebrew died a while ago, Jacob Rosenwald, a great and eminent and noble Hebrew, and he did what many moneyed men failed to do. While he lived, he scattered his benefactions for the benefit of the underprivileged and the poor and the needy, in an overflowing the generous way, so that always America will be a grateful debtor to that great Hebrew. And there are many more like him whose names could be called, who in life's middle time reached the acme of their powers in the world of business and put into motion influences greatest and most significant in life's middle time. But now the opposite is true. Men reach their defeats most sadly of all, in life's middle time. When we turn to the Bible, it is vivid with examples of men who went down in the middle passage of life. There was Samson, the strongest man of all, and yet under the arts and wiles and sinister atmosphere into which he should not have gone, he went down, and his power was gone. He wished not that God was departed from him until he began to try to voice his strength as before and found himself a weakling, a defeated man. The psalmist David went down in life's middle time. And if one wants to know how penitent he was, go read the 51st Psalm and keep reading it. As he voices his cry because of his going down in life's middle time. Solomon went down to an awful degree in life's middle time. And so did King Saul. And so did Judas. And so did Demas. In the scriptures, the evidences stand out in lives of how perilous is life's middle time. Men go down then, and women to an awful degree. I said advisedly, as a preacher, 42 years and some longer in this place, if the moral tragedies of this city were all fully uncovered and disclosed, and of our land beyond the city, we would find that the gravest defalcations and downfalls have come in life's middle time. You may play fast and loose today and keep well, and go along and smoke and joke and go along. Retribution follows in the wake of the lives of men and women. Be sure your sin will find you out. Whatsoever a man soweth, that shall he also reap. If we sow to the flesh, we shall certainly of the flesh reap corruption. But if we sow to the Spirit, thank God, we shall of the Spirit reap life everlasting. Men go down in life's middle time. In life's middle time, the instances are everywhere in evidence. Everywhere in evidence. Now the question emerges, why? Why is life's middle time so perilous? So testing? I think there are some answers, not far away at all, but right at hand. For one thing, life's middle time is perilous because it is the time of preoccupation. We're in a groove when we're in life's middle time. We're in a groove. And we like to stay in that groove. We're not likely to be jarred out of that groove. And preoccupation completely enthralls us. That story of Jesus in the Gospel of Luke about the rich farmer comes to mind. Ground of a certain rich man brought for plentifully. And he thought within himself, saying, what shall I do? Because I have no room there to bestow my fruits and my goods. And he said, this will I do. I will pull down my barns and build greater. And there will I bestow all my fruits and my goods. And I will say to my soul, soul, thou hast much goods laid up for many years. Take thine ease, eat, drink, and be merry. Wasn't it fine? Not at all. Not at all for a man who has to die. For a man who has to give his account to God. For a man who must face the judgment. Now take the next sentence of that story. I've just quoted. But God, there's the unseen factor. But the certain factor with whom we have to deal, every one of us. But God said unto him, thou fool, this night shall thy life be required of thee. With all your big flan barns stored with grains and fruits and foods enough to last you against many a long drought, tonight you're going to die and leave it all. Then whose shall those things be which thou hast provided? So is he that layeth up treasure for himself and is not rich toward God. The peril of middle time, preoccupation. Keeping right on in the groove. And that word groove and grave are from the same root. Keeping right on in the groove, in the grave. Men in life's middle time, they're away from the mighty influences of youth when they're so easily impressed. Now they're preoccupied. Still again, the time is the perilous time, the supremely testing time, because of the easy loss of idealism that can come to us all. Well, does the Bible say, where there is no vision, the people perish. Where there is no vision, the people perish. Secularism, materialism, if these be given the regnancy, the people will perish. Where there is no vision, the people perish. Men must have vision, and women must have vision of ideals and standards, high and holy and worthy, humanity helping and God honoring. Men must have these visions all along. Our life will become drab and secular and overgrown with materialistic atmosphere. Secularism is the great peril of us all, secularism. What shall it profit a man if he gain the whole world and lose his own soul? What shall it profit a city if it gains factories and skyscrapers and vast bank deposits and all kinds of material accessories, if it shall lose sight of the truth that a human life is more important than all these habiliments put together? Well, does the poet sing for us, Edwin Markham? We are blind until we see that in the human plan, nothing is worth the making unless it makes the man. Why build these cities glorious without this worthy plan? In vain we build the work until we also build the man. A human life is the asset of measurable, comparable value. Now we're in peril of losing the vision of human life and all that goes along with human life. We're in peril of losing idealism. Young men dream dreams like Joseph dreamed. Young men dream. Little children dream. The little boy says, wait till I get to be a man and I'll do so and so and so. Now the peril is that after we get to be men and women and out into the thick of the fight, and the years come on with all that battle and burden and that changes, often very drab changes, that we lose sight of vision and look downward and become muckrakers when we fall toward the hill. Oh, the peril of an idol. When a man can't dream anymore. When he can't unfold great visions anymore. When his hands are drab and tired and his brain is hard. And when he quits dreaming and hoping and planning and building, how perilous his plight is with idealism gone. And there's some sins that bring us down. The sin most of all reprobated in the Bible is the sin of avarice, the sin of covetousness. The Bible reminds us that the love of money is the root of every kind of evil. And Paul reminds us that men in their quest to get money, and when they get it, often pierce themselves through with many sorrows and drown themselves in the depth of perdition. And it doesn't get the fathers and mothers that made it unless a miracle of mercy is interposed. It'll get their children and grandchildren. There are some sins that society utterly brands. It brands the sin of lying, the sin of libertinism, the sin of theft, and it will drive such sinners from the pale of society. But here is a sin corroding and carking and eating and consuming, the sin of covetousness. The sin of avarice. And men pile up and pile up and pile up and then come home one day and eat a big dinner and push their chair back and fall on the floor. The heart gone. And life's big things have been missed. And the glorious standards that ought to be maintained by every man have not been maintained by this man who has suddenly gone hence to make his answer to God for the deeds done in the body. Down the Jericho roads of life, there are many in desperate plight. Well, now, what are we to do about it? How are we to overcome? How should we set about hedging against any such defeat, any such tragedy as breaking down in life's middle time? Two or three simple words, and one is, we, everyone, want to take a faithful inventory of our own lives. Where am I now? Where am I? What about my case? Where am I? Is it all true and fair and square? Where am I? Am I behaving as one ought to behave? The Bible has a great word about self-examination. The Bible warns against self-deception. That's a warning word in the Bible, isn't it? Listen. There is a way which seemeth right unto a man, but the end thereof are the ways of death. That's in the Bible. And that word of Jesus, oh, how ominous it is. I hear it with a tremble, tremble yet. Not everyone that saith unto me, Lord, Lord, shall enter into the kingdom of heaven, but he that doeth the will of my Father who is in heaven. Now next. Many will say unto me in that day, oh, will some of us be from this great audience, here in these, within these walls or out in radio land. Listen to Jesus. Many will say unto me in that day, Lord, Lord, have we not prophesied in thy name? Want some of us preachers? There'll be preachers in perdition, but not true preachers. Not true preachers. There'll be preachers in the realms of the lost, but they're not true preachers. Many will say unto me in that day, Lord, Lord, have we not prophesied in thy name? Weren't we preachers? And in thy name cast out devils. And in thy name done many wonderful works. And then I, the Lord, will profess unto them, depart from me, ye that work iniquity. I never knew you. You were never a man at all. You were never a man when you stood in the pulpit. You were never a man for a second. You were never a man when you passed the plates as a deacon. You were never a man when you pretended to be a Sunday school teacher or leader in this realm or that or the other. You were never a man at all. I tell you, men and women, such a warning as that from the Son of God about self-examination needs to be heeded by every man, even if you're 1,000 years old. Then the counselors of the Bible, they're plain as the fingers on a man's hand. If we are to hedge against the deadly defeats that come with life's middle time, and the defeats that come all along, the counselors of God are very plain. We're to watch against temptation. Enter not into the way of it. Avoid it. Pass not by it. Atmosphere is the great thing in a man's life. Jesus, when he was here in the flesh, never made frontal attacks on great evils. That wasn't his method. But he enslaved men with an atmosphere. And the supreme thing of all is atmosphere. Sometimes men make their frontal attacks on certain great evils and bombard them and go away, and the things are there still. There was a direct attack of that great Titanic steamer as it plowed yonder in the north with its hundreds and hundreds of passengers going at full speed, and it made a frontal attack on a great iceberg, and the big ship with hundreds of lives went down to death. But that same iceberg came on down into the Gulf Stream. And without any sort of bombardment, the Gulf Stream subdued it, conquered it, melted it. That's Christ's method. Now we are to have the right atmosphere. There's the advantage of the Christian college. The incomparable advantage of the Christian college, if it will dare to be a Christian college. If it will pay the price to be a Christian college. Sometimes I have the awful fear that we are in the steps of the secular institutions to a degree utterly indefensible again and again. Atmosphere is the great thing about a church. Atmosphere is the great thing about a man. Atmosphere. Now we are to stay out of the wrong atmosphere and get into the right atmosphere. That's the teaching of Jesus. And we are to watch against the spirit of cynicism. Oh, how terrible is that spirit of cynicism. Blessed is the man that walketh not in the counsel of the ungodly, nor standeth in the way of sinners, nor sitteth in the seat of the scornful. The chief cynic of all is Satan, and men don't need to be his votaries and followers. Cynicism, that word cynic comes, as you know, for the Greek word meaning dog, snarling and snapping and biting. We can do better than to have that attitude toward our fellow humanity. We are to believe the best we can about everybody and put the best interpretation we can upon everybody and in every way undergird and encourage everybody we can. then we are to practice the presence of God. We are to practice the presence of God. As we go along, I'll tell you, men and women, you can't bring up that family like you ought. You not give the right lessons to those children as you ought. You not give the witness and do the work that you ought unless all along you practice the presence of God. Leave me not to myself. God avert. Teach me. Inspirit me. Fortify me. Be with me. And help me in the duties and responsibilities in home, in state, in church, everywhere we are practicing the presence of God. And we link our lives with our Lord, not only trusting Him as Savior, but serving Him. Serving Him. Obeying Him. I read this past week the account of a preacher that had a great deal of eminence. He was brilliant, scintillatingly brilliant, not in this country, but in another, in the English land. I read the account of him carefully this week, and a critic interpreting him said he loved God after a commonplace sort of fashion. Oh, what an indictment. A preacher loving God after a commonplace sort of fashion? A mother loving her child or children after a commonplace sort of fashion? A patriot loving his country after a commonplace sort of fashion? Our best, our utmost, our worthiest needs to be dedicated to Christ while we are here. And we need to stand up for him everywhere.
My attention was brought to the story of an infidel in one of the cities who had a great way of getting on the street corners and derating Christianity. One day he was more violent and vehement than ever, one night it was, and a great crowd got round him as he lampooned the churches and derided Christianity and mocked the gentle, glorious name of Christ. And when he had got through, he said, "Is there anybody here audacious enough or brave enough to get up and answer me?" And everybody was quiet. But there were two young Sunday school girls, about 16, who loved Christ and had taken their places in his church. And one of them spoke up and said, "Sir, we can't speak, but we can sing." And they mounted the same box on which he had stood and sang, "Stand up. Stand up for Jesus. Ye soldiers of the cross, lift high his royal banner. It must not suffer loss. From victory unto victory, his army shall he lead, till every foe is vanquished, and Christ is Lord indeed." And the same crowd that had applauded the diatribes of the infidel were subdued and softened by the courageous witness given by these young Christian girls. Oh, let be for Christ. And we Christians now, what need that we be Christians in this incomparably tragic hour of the world? I wonder if you've read Lord Earl Grey's book, his autobiography. If you have, you were impressed profoundly, as was I, when you came that night when England declared war, August 3rd, 1914, when Parliament, after an awfully serious session, declared war. Earl Grey, one of the leading members of the Parliament and of the Cabinet, went to his room in the War Office and sat there looking out at the window all night. He didn't disrobe. He didn't have the first admonition toward sleep. He sat there with a friend, and as the morning came, he saw the street men going out and putting out the lights, the lamps that lighted up the city. And Earl Grey said, "The lamps are going out all over Europe, and they'll not be lit again in our lifetime." And he stated the truth. The lamps did go out all over Europe. Great nations were fairly assassinated, and uncounted millions are dead under sovereign sea. Oh, Christian men and women, these are days when we ought to die to be Christians. These are days when we ought to tread the path of prayer. These are days when our benevolence ought to be so shining and glorious that even Satan would be discouraged by the sight of our sacrificial devotion to Christ. Stand up. Stand up for Jesus. Ye soldiers of the cross, lift high his royal banner. It must not suffer loss. From victory unto victory, his army shall he lead, till every foe is vanquished, and Christ is Lord indeed.